This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Okay, there's a big conundrum about mammograms. You know, a lot of women each year join the ranks of breast cancer survivors. There's a whole ethos surrounding this, is this idea that because of better methods of detection, we can find cancer early, we can treat it aggressively with surgery, sometimes with radiation, sometimes with chemotherapy, and thus we can save lives. So more and more women are joining the ranks of, quote, cancer survivors. But the question is, did the mammograms really save their lives? A couple of problems have been pointed out with mammograms. On the one hand, there are cases where mammograms make a crucial difference in survival. Catching cancer early can make a difference, and properly treated, we can reduce the risk of cancer recurrence and death. But it turns out that there's a big medical mystery. Mammograms don't save that many lives. And this is according to studies, especially in countries where they're less aggressive about doing mammograms, countries like Scandinavia, where they've actually questioned the utility of doing mammograms. There's also a question of, you know, when do you start doing mammograms? In the United States, we start at 40. In many other countries, they don't start until 50, and it doesn't seem to make much of a difference. They get less mammograms. It doesn't seem to make a difference in terms of survival. And so, part of the problem is that some cancers, when discovered by mammogram, it doesn't matter, because our treatment for breast cancer, unfortunately, is not at a stage where it's that definitive that every cancer that's discovered is curable. Some cancers that are discovered by mammogram, in spite of all manner of aggressive treatment, the women go on to have widespread disease, cancer metastases everywhere, and ultimately die of breast cancer, regardless of whether they got a mammogram. On the other hand, there is the notion that some of the cancers that we're finding may be small and inconsequential. Yeah, that's a hard notion to swallow. Is a cancer? I mean, you know, find a cancer, don't just stand there, do something. But is it possible that what we're finding are cancers that ultimately might have killed these self-same women at the age of 130, which is inconsequential because they would have long since died of other causes. They're very slow-growing, non-aggressive cancers, such as we sometimes find in male prostate cancer. We know that in very early prostate cancer, it's quite possible that a watchful waiting approach to early prostate cancer makes sense. So they just came out with a big study that may help to shed light on this dilemma. A study involving thousands of breast cancer cases released a couple of weeks ago, reading a report from NPR, concludes that a significant proportion of tumors detected through mammography are not small because they're found early. Okay, they say, well, we found this tiny tumor. It's lucky, you know, the notion is, oh my goodness, I'm so lucky that I go for my annual mammogram because I found it early. You know, it just before it got large and aggressive. They're not small because they're found early. Instead, the tumors are small because they are biologically prone to slow growth. They're small because they're not very dangerous. Okay. One researcher here says, for over 100 years, we've known that small breast cancers have a much better prognosis than large breast cancers. We always assumed that it was because we were catching the small cancers early, and then that's why the cure rate was much better. So like this is the whole premise of cancer screening is early detection saves lives. And they still have campaigns. And, the campaigns are well-meaning, but there's also a little bit of a follow the money trail aspect to them because they're sponsored in part by companies that make equipment that is designed to do mammograms. That's a profitable business. Companies like GE make, the mammogram screening equipment. Then there's also the doctors who are very, happy to do some good and catch cancer early and treat it aggressively. They believe they're onto something. It's well-meaning, but it also drums up business for them. And then, oh, by the way, they're the companies that make surgical equipment and radiation equipment and companies that even are makers of drugs, chemotherapy and some of the new breakthrough drugs that are used for treatment of breast cancer. So the results were published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. And what they say is that not all breast cancers are alike. The virulence of breast cancer varies tremendously. Some cancers are extremely fast growing and aggressive, and others that are extremely slow growing. And it may take 15 or 20 years for these small tumors to cause any problems. So you can imagine that, and here's another thing. It's like women are being screened now into their 70s and 80s with mammograms. And if you find a small cancer and treat it aggressively, that may be a cancer that could develop into a problem 15 or 20 years hence, long after an older woman may have passed away from another cause, a more common cause of death like heart disease. So, it would be not such a big deal if the treatment for breast cancer were simple and benign, but it can be arduous. After screening for a mammogram, you find something, there's multiple biopsies, surgery, chemo, radiation, and lots of stress for a tumor that may ultimately not pose a health threat. So we have a familiar figure stepping up here. He's someone who you've interviewed here on Intelligent Medicine. He's Dr. H. Gilbert Welch. Dr. Welch is a professor of medicine, community and family medicine at Dartmouth College, and he's author of a book called Overdiagnosis. And he is a big believer in the notion that we overtest and we spot too many diseases that are treated aggressively where there's not a strong scientific rationale for aggressive treatment. He says, quote, "I think we all need to realize that we probably oversold the idea that looking for cancer early is the best way to avoid it." He goes on, "Mammography is a really close call. It's a choice. We've exaggerated its benefits and we've sort of understated its harms." He's not saying, don't get a mammogram, but he's saying, let's, hit the pause button on our zealous application of early screening. So there is a debate over mammography. And, there's some people, and I have a family member who is a radiologist who specializes in breast cancer monitoring and detection. And when I talk to her about this, like we get together for a holiday dinner or something, she just gets really, really angry and says, "Hey, this kind of talk dissuades women from getting proper testing. And many women will die because they put their reliance on these skeptics who tell them that there's no need to get screening. And ultimately, some women will benefit from the screening. And yes, there is, perhaps some unnecessary overzealous treatment, but it's a conundrum. It's a dilemma. And what we need, and I've been saying this for years now, is we need better tests for cancer. We need to be able to discriminate between cancers which are relatively early and benign and which can stand minimal treatment versus cancers which are very dangerous, which need to be aggressively treated. And we need better tests, tests which will light up cancer in a better fashion than mammography. By the way, the other problem occurs with mammography. You can miss cancer. You can have cancers growing and concealed by surrounding tissue that is opaque and hides the cancer. And then, you know, even if you've had multiple mammograms, all of a sudden, boom, you know, where'd that come from? You know, oh, you must have had it for years. We just didn't see it. Well, you know, can you sue the doctor for malpractice, for misinterpreting the mammogram? That is a major cause of litigation. It's tough being a radiologist these days, because if you miss a cancer, it turns out to be something that you know, lawyers get onto. But, you know, we need better tests to help us discriminate. We need more targeted therapy. Which breast cancers and other cancers need to be treated with aggressive radiation, chemotherapy, and now with the advent of immunotherapy, can we get in early and treat cancer with effective treatments before it spreads with innovative therapies? Or in some cases, should we simply let it alone? You know, modify the lifestyle, take better care of diet, exercise, and take certain supplements which have anti-cancer effects. That too, I think, will be part of the cancer landscape going forward. But we need more discriminating tests to tell us which patients are suitable for which types of therapy. Okay, folks, now for something completely different, let's hear from one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is myfavoriteoliveoil.com. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make our podcasts free and available to you. Can you exercise too much? Well, I kind of hate doing these stories because the vast majority of people don't exercise enough, and they use stories like this to, you know, lay back on the sofa and, you know, laugh at the people who are, you know, jogging by or riding by below their living room window, and they feel justified in their sedentary habits because when they hear stories like this, they go, oh, those people are killing themselves. I, on the other hand, am conserving energy, and I'm not prey to these hazards of excess exercise. I'm personally very affirmative about exercise, but I have to say that I am no longer interested in doing ultra you know, marathon type exploits. A lot of that is about ego, and some of it is about a form of obsessive working out that maybe, I don't know, maybe people at some level feel bored or unhappy, or they get hooked on the exhilaration of feeling utterly gassed and exhausted. There's a sort of an endorphin high that you get from exercising intensely. And I have to say that, you know, on rainy days or, you know, times where the gym is closed, I get a little antsy. Maybe I am a little addicted to exercise. But there's a new hazard of intense exercise. And, you know, first of all, we have to define what is intense exercise. According to this study, those who regularly exercise for 2 hours or more per day could be doing more harm to their bodies than good. Well, not that many of us do that, but people, you know, that I know who train for triathlons and Ironman competition and marathons, they may be doing that. You know, athletes sometimes they run, you know, 6 or 8 miles in the morning, and then they, you know, do another 10K. In the afternoon, two bouts of exercise. That's a lot. And so this comes to us from an Australian sports journal entitled Alimentary Pharmacology and Therapeutics. And what they say is that intense exercise can trigger leaky gut syndrome. Okay, leaky gut syndrome is a change in the permeability or a leakiness of the intestinal lining. And this is an important concept in integrative medicine because patients who have a wide gamut of symptoms, they may have chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, or alternatively, they may have a true autoimmune disorder like rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis. They may have a change in the permeability of their intestinal tract whereby toxins, bacterial byproducts, can traverse the intestinal wall, get into the systemic circulation, and create a systemic toxicity. Or another way that this can be problematic is that dietary proteins that are supposed to be properly absorbed may be in an undigested fashion absorbed as large macromolecules that get into the bloodstream and may travel to the joints, as in the case of arthritis, or cross the blood-brain barrier in the case of multiple sclerosis. And these proteins may trick the immune system into attacking the target organ. And it could be any organ. It could be the skin in some autoimmune skin problem, like severe eczema. It can be the brain in multiple sclerosis. It can be the joints, of course. It can be the liver, autoimmune hepatitis. Virtually every organ of the body is potentially susceptible to autoimmunity. What they say here in this article, and it's from the Telegraph, which is a popular newspaper, so the article's a little dumbed down, but it does summarize the scientific conclusions of the study. It's believed that the resultant leakage of toxic waste is a primary cause of multiple sclerosis and chronic fatigue, and has a role to play in many other illnesses. They say those putting in the hours at the gym might be better off putting aside some time on the sofa. Okay, so, I mean, what any type of stress, severe stress, can cause this. Sleep deprivation could cause this. Intense, chronic emotional stress or post-traumatic stress disorder could alter intestinal permeability. What are some of the solutions? Well, you know, chill out on exercise, take a rest, take probiotics, take gut healing nutrients like glutamine, consider immunoglobulin support with colostrum. Colostrum is also something that supports gastrointestinal health. Lactoferrin is something that is helpful. N-acetylglucosamine is one of the gut healing nutrients. There's some herbs that may be helpful, having a demulcent effect like aloe. There are a variety of ways to approach healing the gut. It's a big theme. And I recently saw a patient with, I think, this phenomenon, not so much from exercise, but he was a young man who was developing real, joint stiffness. And he was having extreme fatigue. And it was found that he had a high rheumatoid factor, which is a indication of early onset rheumatoid arthritis. And through diet change, certain supplements, we have managed to turn this around. He just saw me in the office. He's asymptomatic, no joint pain whatsoever. He's able to exercise. It was really by paying attention to the gut that we, in part, began to heal him. Other issues related to excess exercise, we talked about this before, higher risk of cardiac arrhythmias. There was a study in the European Heart Journal 2013, which measured the heart rhythms of over 52,000 cross-country skiers. Now, that's a very arduous sport. It's a real endurance sport, akin to long-distance running or cycling. And they found that the risk of arrhythmias increased with every race completed. It was up to 30% higher for those who competed year on year for a period of 5 years. And the higher the exercise intensity, the greater the risk of arrhythmias. So for me, The good news for me is that I am slow and somewhat lazy. So I cannot achieve such high levels of exercise intensity. This morning before recording this podcast, I took a 24-mile bike ride, which is, from the standpoint of these hazards, is considered a relatively moderate workout. I mean, some of the people who are at risk for this, they, you know, think nothing of doing what's called a century, which is a 100-mile bike ride. I have a patient who routinely competes in 200-mile and 400-mile biking events, and he's just this side of 60. And I am concerned about him, but you know, we try to keep him in good shape. This is his thing, and we're trying to support him with the proper nutrition and the proper diet, proper supplements that help fend off problems. But you know, it's a little bit like driving your car. You know, most of you have high performance cars where you can see the RPMs, and when you go in the red zone, that means you're putting stress on your engine. I do not have a lead foot. I'm a very careful and moderate driver, so that red zone is never attained in my car, and I, you know, plan to get upwards of 100,000 miles out of my car. So, you know, if you want long mileage, you know, moderate your exercise. You know, exercise is about achieving health, and yes, you know, there are, you know, there's the glory and going for it. And if there weren't people out there who were champion athletes and performing amazing feats of endurance, who would be out there to motivate us amateur duffers? But be careful that you don't push yourself into the red zone, because leaky gut syndrome, cardiac arrhythmias, high levels of cortisol, which can cause osteoporosis paradoxically, because, yeah, the exercise is weight-bearing, but high levels, continuous levels of high cortisol can have a bone-weakening effect. There you have it. There are some downsides to the active lifestyle when carried to an extreme. Okay, this is a big question, and we're going to try and shed some light on it. Should women who are concerned about breast cancer take in soy? And, you know, soy has been stigmatized and debated. It's highly controversial. Is soy a good or bad when it comes to breast cancer? I remember very early in my career, in the 1980s, I was invited to participate on a panel. I was the only integrative doctor on a panel talking about breast cancer. And the issue came up, and they turned to me, should women who have breast cancer take in soy? And I answered that probably soy was what is called a natural SERM, a synthetic estrogen receptor modulator, like tamoxifen. Tamoxifen is a drug that's often given to women, and now Arimidex is given to women to hormonally block proliferation of cancer cells in hormone-receptive cancers, and that soy was probably okay. And I remember some of the conventional gynecologists who were in this panel wheeling on me, and you know, and you know, turning against me, as it were, saying, "Well, we have to be very careful. You know, Dr. Hoffman believes that it is safe to take soy and maybe even beneficial, but the word's not in. We need to do more studies." And soy, because of its estrogenic effects, soy we know contains diadzin and genistein, which are natural compounds that have estrogen-like effects, and so, you know, the concern is, could that stoke the proliferation of breast cancer? And so that question was unresolved in the 1980s, although I had a feeling that soy would be okay. We have now a new study, and it's reported on in Natural Medicine Journal. It's a journal that I sometimes write for. I recently wrote an article for them on ulcerative colitis, and one of my good colleagues on the journal editorial board, Tina Kaksor, a naturopathic physician, writes a very nice review talking about a 2017 study entitled Dietary Isoflavone Intake and All-Cause Mortality in Breast Cancer Survivors. Very cool study. But the background on this is that there was a study in 2009 from China which showed that not only was soy not harmful in breast cancer survivors in China, but it actually was somewhat beneficial. It somewhat reduced the risk of recurrence and death. So some people have criticized that study by saying, well, the Chinese are different. And why are they different? Are they genetically different? Well, not so much that they're different makeup. It's just that soy is such a traditional part of the Chinese diet that it may be that an American woman who never eats soy gets breast cancer and then all of a sudden decides that soy is a really good thing to eat, or you know, they should take genistein or diazine supplements derived from soy. Is that such a good idea? Because Chinese women have been continuously exposed to moderate amounts of soy from dietary sources, maybe even in utero. And so it may be a different ballgame when it comes to American women. And that's sort of where it's been left. Like, yeah, we think it's beneficial in the Chinese, but we're not sure if it's okay for Americans. So a new study to examine association between dietary intake of isoflavones and all-cause mortality in a multi-ethnic cohort of women diagnosed with breast cancer in the U.S. So they, you know, they had Hispanics, they had blacks, they had Asian Americans, and they had whites. 6,235 of them, and they followed them. And they looked at the highest intake of daily isoflavone versus the lowest. And what they found was that there was a 21% reduced risk of death in those consuming the highest amount of soy versus the lowest amount of soy. Of interest is that the reduction in death was only evident in women who had estrogen receptor negative tumors. Not that the women who had estrogen receptor positive tumors were hastened in dying of breast cancer, but the protective effect was mostly seen in the estrogen receptive negative tumors, which is interesting because there are other compounds in soy which may have anti-cancer effects, tyrosine kinase inhibitors and the like, some of which may not have yet been characterized. So what's interesting is that it seemed that the protective effect was mediated not through a hormonal effect. Certainly the hormonal effect was not harmful of that these estrogen-like compounds, but there was something else going on that was protective. So the findings suggest that not only is soy probably safe for women with breast cancer, but it may be protective. And it also may be, you know, they're talking about death from all causes, so you know, it may be that soy has benefits in terms of overall health, not related to breast cancer survival. But the key finding is, to date, not a single study of moderate soy consumption has found detrimental effects in any woman with a history of breast cancer, whether it's premenopausal or postmenopausal, ER negative or ER positive. Okay, so, you know, that's a green light on soy consumption. Of course, this is pretty good evidence that soy may be beneficial, but really the most definitive study would be to take a bunch of women newly diagnosed with breast cancer, divide them into groups, feed them soy or feed them you know, soy supplements, and then follow them going forward. That would be like a double-blind placebo-controlled study, which this isn't. This is a retrospective study. It's a survey going back in time and is not necessarily the highest level of scientific evidence, but The good news is that harm was not detected in women who consume soy. It did not create any problems. And if anything, there was a strong signal towards benefit of soy consumption. So that's the story on soy. Okay, folks, that's all for today. I hope you enjoyed this news update on from the Intelligent Medicine Front Lines. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us.